From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another try at a ceasefire in Syria.
We paid much attention to the fight against terrorism.
That was Russia's President Vladimir Putin at a joint press conference Wednesday with Turkey's President Recep Erdogan.
We agreed to intensify the cooperation between the security agencies and ministries of defense.
For more on the latest from Syria, we spoke with our regular contributor, political analyst, and geopolitical lecturer at Moscow State University, Mark Sloboda.
Basically, the Russian government, Iran, and Turkey, with the backing in the background of the Syrian government, announced a new, not new, plan for what they are calling de-escalation zones in Syria. For de-escalation zones, and Erdogan has even commented to the Turkish press on this about the exact terminology used. He preferred safe zones, but he said that de-escalation zones is the term that has gained traction, and you know, but trying to equate them as the same thing. This is, in my reading, a diplomatic ploy by Russia. And I find there's very little substance to this supposed plan at all. I find that it is merely a repackaging of an existing failed ceasefire, which Russia, Iran, and Turkey are supposed to be the guarantees for under the Astana format, which has completely and utterly failed. Largely due to the fact that Turkey continues to supply al-Qaeda and other jihadi groups, Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, and others in Syria from its territory, arm, train, and one would salaries through the MOM centers, which supposedly the Trump administration has either stopped funding or at least throttled down on, depending on the reports. But even if they have stopped, we can assume that Saudi, Qatar, and Turkey are picking up the slack in that regard, because they recently launched a major offensive that took the Syrian government two or three weeks to get a handle on and turn around, and that was in Hama and East Homs province. But this ceasefire has largely completely failed, and large numbers of Turkish proxies fighting under the banner of their Euphrates shield zone that they invaded and occupied a large swath of north central Syria, north of Aleppo, in the name of fighting terrorism. Never mind the fact that, of course, they brought a lot of terrorists along with them. Large numbers of these proxies, which include FSA groups, which are at best you could call them hardcore Islamists, along with other outright Salafist jihadis such as Ahrar al-Sham and others, they were openly seen fighting in this most recent al-Qaeda-led offensive against the Syrian government. Turkish equipment was seen as well, Turkish military equipment being used by these proxies in this fighting. So this is one of the reasons why the ceasefire, the last ceasefire, no one has admitted that it doesn't exist anymore, but it hasn't existed for months now, if it ever really did. De-escalation package that is now being presented seems like simply a repackaging of this failed ceasefire in new clothes. And I think part of the reason I want to highlight articles by both Alexander Mercouris at the Duran and a recent blog post by Moon of Alabama on the subject. I largely concur with both of them, that this is a diplomatic ploy. This is Russia trying to own the idea of safe zones at this point, because this is something that Turkey has been arguing for years. This would be in Turkey's idea of a safe zone. This would basically be the story of Benghazi and Libya all over again, where you create a safe area, an essentially no-fly zone that becomes a bombing zone for your proxies to operate freely out of, right, using civilians as human shields. And that's not even hidden. I mean, when the Senate, the U.S. Senate was talking about implementing them, and its proponents were arguing their case, they were arguing that rebels would be safe there, and then, oh, and we could bring civilians in too.
Right. So, I mean, we're talking about a de facto partitioning.
Yeah, a de facto partition of the country into areas. But there's always, of course, the very real possibility that these zones would then be used to launch full-scale regime, right, change operations.
Right. And it's a base for an offensive, yeah, basically, right?
It is my opinion that when Russia first intervened in the fall of 2015, it did so explicitly to stop one of these safe zone plans that it looks like Turkey had finally convinced Obama to commit to. He was dragging his feet on it. And then Russia intervened to forestall exactly that. Trump administration in a recent phone call with Putin was again bringing this up this idea of safe zones. Turkey was pushing for it too. So it looks like, in my opinion, that this announcement of de-escalation zones is an attempt to own the idea of this, kind of a poison pill, right, so that the U.S. can't turn around Trump, because it would have to be with the approval of the U.S. Turkey already has an effective safe zone in their occupation, Euphrates Shield occupation zone north of Aleppo. But it's been hemmed in. It has been contained at this point. And this was showed some very interesting, again, coordination between Russia, the Syrian government, the Kurds, and the Trump administration in around this Euphrates Shield occupation zone. They have moved U.S. troops to the border between this zone and the Kurdish-controlled SDF, the Syrian, so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which are essentially the YPG and a few Arab tribes thrown in for face paint, for veneer.
Right, right.
Turkey is extremely upset about this, of course, because at least one of the goals of their invasion of Syria is to fight the Kurds in Syria, the YPG, which they see as an extension of the PKK in their own country. So the U.S. Moved troops through Syrian government-controlled territory, and the Kurds transferred control of territory. This is the U.S.-allied Kurds. The SDF transferred territory to the Syrian government and with Russian troops, with the idea that Russian troops there would prevent Turkey from attacking the area. The U.S. also had troops in the area. Now the U.S. has moved troops elsewhere on the Syrian and Turkish border to prevent Turkey from attacking in other places along the length of the Syrian-Turkish border. Mm. And we've even heard threats from Turkish ministers that Turkey could accidentally hit U.S. soldiers launching an attack against the Kurds.
Well, that's credible. I mean, they shot down a Russian plane, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there have been numerous incidents so far. And every Syrian, Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah soldier and Syrian civilian that dies in Syria because of this rebellion, rebels as they call it, dies with their blood on Erdogan's hands, because without Turkish territory, Turkish arms and supplies, this simply would cease to exist within a few months.
Yep. You know, let me just ask you, all of this, all these developments, including the announcement or re-announcement of this repackaged deal that, if I'm not mistaken, is the same one that the U.S. like bombed out of existence within hours after it was announced under the Obama administration.
It's very similar to that. Yeah. Yes.
This all happens while Erdogan is in Sochi and has a meeting with President Putin, a joint press conference, and all of that. While Putin and Trump are speaking on the phone, while Tillerson and Lavrov are involved. In other words,
Erdogan is in Washington as well.
That's right. The principals are all deeply engaged with each other right now. While you have this, an apparent concession by Russia to this idea that they had originally acted to thwart. And it's kind of an odd context because there hasn't been any military reversal at all. To the contrary, the conditions have been very favorable for Russia and the Syrian government. Why is this playing out this way right now? What kind of back game do you think is underway?
Well, I still see this as a war of maneuver at this point. There's no question that the long-term trend is definitely with the Syrian government and Russian, Iranian, Hezbollah, the whole resistance axis there. However, a large part of the uncertainty comes from no one knows exactly what the Trump administration is doing. On one hand, there are reports that they've stopped funding the quote Free Syrian Army, which is now essentially become a Turkish creature. Right. It was always jointly supported before. Now it's essentially completely owned by the Turks. Mm. We have seen cooperation with the Russians around Manbij, with the Kurds, again with the U.S. troops moving to the Syrian-Turkish border in East Syria, just as Russian troops are moving to the Syrian-Turkish border in West Syria around Afrin Canton, both in an attempt to contain and prevent Turkish expansion into Syria. We have seen some limited signs of cooperation in East Syria around Raqqa, the approach to Raqqa between the U.S. and Turkey. But at the same time, we've had these U.S. strikes on a Syrian airbase in response to what they allege was a chemical weapon attack on an al-Qaeda stronghold, Khan Shaykhun, of which there is no, absolutely zero, independent, objective confirmation of. And most recently, the most recent news I've heard is that the al-Qaeda in control of the town of Khan Shaykhun have now cemented over what they claimed on social media was the impact crater, which the Russia wants the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on the ground to inspect that site and prove whether or not there was actually sarin there. Well, evidently, al-Qaeda has thoughtfully commenced a program of road repairs.
Yeah, and covered over paving over the crime scene, basically.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly. And at the same time, there are some very worrying developments and rumors coming out of Jordan. Jordan was initially another area for the U.S. To launch rebels out of, in the south of Syria, the southern front. This was stopped largely after Russia's intervention, and evidently Russia threatened Jordan and a deal was reached, whereas it largely stopped to operate and the Southern Front went quiet without the active support, the funding, the arms, the supplies. The Southern Front went completely quiet. But recently there's been some disturbing news about U.S. troops down there in Jordan and gathering again, trying to again manufacture a quote moderate unquote force. And there's fears that the U.S. with some proxies and so could basically go into East Syria out of Jordan and thereby attempt both from the north and the south to cut off East Syria and partition it from the rest of the country. This would be the neocons, the Brookings Institute Plan B, deconstructing Syria, creating a Salafistan in East Syria. But the problems with this is there's no partners for the U.S. to work with. They can't occupy this area with Kurds. Kurds are not welcomed by the majority religiously fundamentalist Sunni population in East Syria, and they don't have the numbers for it to begin with. Al-Qaeda is trapped in the middle of Syria, largely in Idlib province and in East Homs, and there just is no force able to do this. The Turks wanted to be the U.S.'s partners in this, and they would presumably move the FSA and Ahrar al-Sham out of central Syria into East Syria along with them, their proxies. But the Trump administration has said no, they don't want to work with Turkey. They've been quite adamant about it. In fact, they've been cooperating with the Syrian government and Russia to contain Turkey. They want to continue working with the Kurds, but this risks their relationship with Turkey, who is a NATO member. And we have to remember that we have NATO members now operating at cross purposes. This is the U.S. and Turkey operating at cross purposes in Syria, and Turkey directly threatening U.S. troops.
I mean, we have all these bizarre things going on. You have
instead of
a line dance, it's like everyone's paired off into these, you know, changing partners, almost like going through a square dance or something. Where on this transaction we're partnering with the Russians, on this transaction we're partnering with the Turks, on this transaction we're partnering with the Kurds, and then you've got the Kurds are several factions. You've got the U.S. Pentagon-backed proxies in Syria shooting
the CIA-backed ones. CIA-backed FSA.
Yeah. I mean, it's you can't, you know, really, literally can't choose the players without a scorecard.
Yeah, I have never been able to find any coherency in the U.S. position, other than the Pentagon has largely refused to train Islamists and jihadis. Every time it has been coerced into doing so, a few of them have ended up going full jihadi and killing some U.S. troops with suicide attacks in the process. So the Pentagon has always preferred to work with the Kurds and focus on the mission of fighting ISIS in East Syria. Meanwhile, the CIA has no such compunctions about working with the Islamists and the jihadis, and has long been working with them, has been training them, has had just as much money or more. This has been reported by the Washington Post years ago, a program to arm, train, and salary some 10,000, and that was 2 years ago, forces out of South Syria, which largely then just filtered into Al-Qaeda and Ahrar al-Sham. But in multiple places in North Syria, you've had a CIA-backed FSA routinely fighting Pentagon-backed Kurdish SDF because they have never been partnered. And it's just been a mess. Now, Russia's game with Turkey. Of course, you know, Turkey shot down a Russian plane. Russia enacted sanctions. There was real possibility of conflict between the two of them. And certainly Turkey has long been at a proxy war, now pretty much a direct war with their invasion of Syria. But Russia's operating under the maxim of keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. Russia has tried repeatedly through the Geneva process and working with the U.S. to come up with a political settlement that would preserve largely the Syrian government so that, you know, we don't see a complete regime change and the country fall to Al-Qaeda, Ahrar al-Sham, ISIS, or any combination of the three. or, you know, the other 31 flavors of jihad. But the U.S., you know, whoever, whether the Pentagon is responsible, the neocons has kept sabotaging whenever these agreements are made or doesn't fully back them to begin with. And Russia's grown increasingly frustrated over the past 2 years. They don't want to be involved in a long-term quagmire in Syria. They do recognize that, you know, on the strength of their military momentum, they need a political settlement. But that has been denied them. So they saw an opportunity to try to seduce Turkey, which was having bad relations with the EU and the US over the issues of migrants and democracy and other issues, away from them, and potentially even causing a split, a rift of some sorts, you know, at least tensions within NATO. And that by cutting a deal with Turkey, which by now has been the sole source of supplies to the rebels, they could essentially end the whole thing if they got Turkey to close off its border and stop supplying, you know, these various jihadis, you know, jihadis and Islamists in Syria. So they could thereby cut Saudi and Qatar, who could never be reasoned with, as well as the US, UK, and France out of the deal by cutting a side deal with Turkey. And Russia does have some leverage because Russian sanctions against Turkey really hit Turkey.
Right.
Turkey is a major economic partner. Russian tourists are very big in the tourism industry and the agricultural exports.
And we're just going there now, too. We're just going into that season again. I mean, I'm sure they're getting a lot of pressure from down below in Turkey.
Yeah. So, and as part of this most recent repackaging, these de-escalation zones, Russia agreed to lift all the remaining sanctions the ban on tourist groups and et cetera, except for the ban on Turkish tomatoes, which evidently Erdogan is still very unhappy about. It sounds small, but it's actually quite a fairly big agricultural deal for both countries. The advantage to Russia from all of this is their agricultural sector, because of the counter sanctions on the West against agricultural projects, and then with Turkey, is that agricultural sector in Russia is booming. There are lots of people here in Russia that never want these sanctions, both against Europe and Turkey, to end, because the Russian agricultural sector is just having a miracle moment at the moment under this economic protection, as the, you know, domestic demand is being met. It's ramping up rather quickly.
Yeah, and you know, not for nothing, most Americans don't know this, but Russian tomatoes are fantastic.
Well, not only Russian tomatoes, but I mean, regularly Russian tomatoes are very good, and it's always amazing. A really strangely huge portion of Russian agriculture essentially comes from small family-owned plots,
right? Natural too,
dachas,
a lot
right?
of organic
no chemicals,
farming.
No preservatives. Right. You know, it's organic, or as they used to call it in the organic food, or as they used to call it in the Soviet Union, food.
Right. right.
And actually, other countries, green, sustainable, are looking at the way Russia has, I think, quite accidentally done agriculture, you know, on a low, you know, not mass produced farm level as a sustainable model. And this the sanctions has really helped it to grow economically. You know, when it was basically under some pressure from joining the WTO and from factory farms in Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, they're feeding
Russian agriculture is great. I get better produce here in Moscow than I ever saw in my life in rural Pennsylvania. The tomatoes from you know, not only Russia but also from Uzbekistan and from Abkhazia and elsewhere are fabulous. They just taste that I never thought a tomato could have. You know, they just exploded. Yeah. Anyway, let's stop selling Russian tomatoes. Yeah. It sounds like a marketing.
Just so people know, I mean, I have to say, there's some remarkable things about food in Russia that I noticed during the Soviet Union, which was the bread, the butter, The caviar, obviously, and I mean, you could live on bread, butter, and tomatoes and caviar very, very well. It's really good stuff.
It's Russian food tends to be simple and bland by Western states. There isn't a lot of spice, but it is all natural and fresh. And yeah. I have gotten so spoiled from having my food, you know, for the last, decade plus in Russia without preservatives, without this strong preservative taste in all my food, that whenever I try something packaged from the U.S. or elsewhere anymore, my mouth revolts because I've had real food for so long. I simply don't want those chemicals in my body anymore.
What is that stuff? Yeah, right. So what do you think is, you know, if the game that's being played here, essentially by Russia, is to let the fighting peter out, so that there's no long term problem, which is what they've been trying to avoid. Quagmire.
Well, even more than that, they keep attempting to either split what small percentage of non-devotedly jihadist rebels remain. You know, whoever they may be, I consider them largely unicorns, that they never really existed. From, in particular, Al-Qaeda and probably Ahrar al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam as well, with Russia, which Russia both considers, terrorist organizations.
Right.
And they've tried repeatedly forcing the U.S. with these ceasefires to separate their rebels from Al-Qaeda, and the U.S. always makes comments about them being marbled together and in close proximity. They're allied together. They're in bed together. I mean, they practically hot rack together. Whatever weapons the U.S. gives are used by their much larger allies. And, I mean, this is coming from the West's biggest experts on Syria and the largest proponents of backing regime change. Sam Heller at Century, who has recently thrown in the towel and given up on the rebels, and Faisal Al-Attani at the Atlantic Council, they both say that Al-Qaeda has long now been the umbrella, they say, under which the rebels have fought. And that if you tried to split the two of them or tried to fight Al-Qaeda, that the rebels would collapse overnight, within a couple months time frame. And that their argument there is simply then don't attack Al-Qaeda.
Right. Well, that's the logic of it. Right.
I've always, as a former U.S. military man, who was trained that Al-Qaeda was the enemy, not the ally of our proxies, I found that quite horrific.
Yeah.
But that's their opinion. But that's what Russia would like to force. They would like either a split or finally for the U.S. and Turkey and others to admit that there is an Al-Qaeda problem in Syria. And ISIS at this point is not really a threat to anyone. I mean, other than the people still under its area of control, right? They haven't had any serious attacks or offensives in a long time. They've done nothing but lose territory. Now it's just a game of who can take a territory away from ISIS, and hold it. The real threat
it's like a political pinata, like
is the explosion of Al-Qaeda. It's gone through two rebrandings. It was Al-Qaeda in Syria, then it was Jabhat al-Nusra, and then something else. Now it's going under the acronym HTS, Tahrir al-Sham. Mm-hmm. But it's still the same group. Even the U.S. government admits that. But the U.S. has long avoided attacking them. To his credit, Trump has done it now more via some air strikes and drone strikes, then certainly more than Obama did, but still, they're still basically still letting the process play out of letting the Syrian government and Russia fight Al-Qaeda alone, hoping that this battering ram can be used to knock down the Syrian government, which is what the game they long played with ISIS.
Right.
I have a feeling that very early in the conflict, when the U.S. government recognized Jabhat al-Nusra as the bad terrorists, that Arvar Bolton. They very much regret that now, because they quickly then became the dominant over all of the rebel groups in Syria, and they essentially they all fight under al-Qaeda's umbrella now, and they can't back them, not openly.
Mark, thank you very much. We'll speak with you again soon.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.